Chapter 18, How interesting it would be to write the story of the experiences in this life of a man who killed himself in his previous life, how he now stumbles against the very demands which had offered themselves before, until he arrives at the realization that he must fulfill those demands. The deeds of the preceding life give direction to the present life. Tolstoy. He felt the message sear itself into his soul. The living words pressed themselves forever into his being. As he rested after leaving his splattered body, we both pondered the different levels of meaning of these outwardly simple words. The session had begun in the usual way. I regressed Pedro using a rapid induction, and he slipped quickly into a deeply tranquil state. His breathing became deep and even, and his muscles relaxed completely. His mind, focused by the hypnosis, penetrated the customary limits of space and time, and he remembered events that had happened far before his birth, as Pedro. I'm wearing brown shoes, he observed as he emerged in the physical confines of a previous incarnation. They're old and battered. I'm a man around 40 years old, he added without my prodding. Balding on the top with hair beginning to gray. My sideburns and beard are gray already. My beard is short, and it's shaved pretty far down my cheeks. He was paying considerable attention to minor details. I appreciated the accuracy of his description. But I was also aware of time slipping by. Go ahead, I advised. Find out what you're doing in this life. Go to the next significant event. My glasses are small and wire-rimmed, he noted, still occupied with physical features. My nose is wide, and my skin is very pale. It is not unusual for a hypnotized patient to be resistant to my suggestions. I have learned that you can't always guide the patient, sometimes the patient has to guide you. What do you do in this life? I asked. I'm a doctor, he answered quickly, a country doctor. I work very hard. The people are mostly poor, but I get by. They are good people overall. Do you know the name of the place where you live? I believe it is in this country, in Ohio. Do you know the year? Late 1800s, I think. And your name? I delicately inquired. Thomas. My name is Thomas. Do you have a last name? It starts with a D. Dixon or Diggins or something like that. I don't feel well, he added. What's wrong? I feel very sad. Very sad. I don't want to go on living. He had jumped ahead to a time of crisis. What is making you so sad? I inquired. I have been despondent before, he clarified. It comes and goes, but this is the worst. It's never been this bad before. The both things are just overwhelming. I can't go on this way. What both things? I echoed. My patient died. The fever killed him. They trusted me to save him. They put their faith in me, and I couldn't. I've let them down. Now they have no husband, no father. They will have to struggle to survive. I couldn't save him. Sometimes patients die despite our best efforts. Especially in the 1800s, I added, paradoxically attempting to ease his guilt and despair over an event that had occurred a century ago. I could not alter the event. Only his attitude toward it. I knew that Thomas had already experienced and acted upon his feelings. What was done. But I could still help Pedro, by helping him to understand, by helping him to see from a higher and more detached perspective. He was silent. I hoped that I had not jarred him from that doctor's lifetime by doing therapy aimed at a level of understanding beyond Thomas. I had not even found out the other event that had precipitated his depression. What is the other thing causing your sadness? I asked, trying to put the genie back into the bottle. My wife has left me, he answered. I was relieved to be talking to Thomas again. She has left you? I repeated, encouraging him to elaborate. Yes, he answered sadly. Our life was too difficult. We couldn't even have children. She went back to her family in Boston. I'm very ashamed. I couldn't help her. I couldn't make her happy. I did not even attempt therapy with his higher mind at this time. Instead, I asked Thomas to move ahead in time to the next important event in that life. We could do the therapy later, as he reviewed this life while still in the hypnotized state, or even later, after he emerged from the hypnosis. "I have a gun," he explained. "I'm going to shoot myself and end this misery." I suppressed the urge to ask him why he chose a gun and not one of the many medicines or poisons available to a doctor of that time. He had made his decision at least a century ago. The question itself was probably my way of intellectualizing his despair, despair of such magnitude as to drive him to self-annihilation. "What happens next?" I asked instead. "I've done it," he said simply. "I've shot myself in the mouth, and now I can see my body. So much blood. So much blood." He had already left his body and was seeing it at a distance. "How do you feel now?" I asked. "Confused. I'm still sad. I'm so tired," he answered. "But I can't rest. Not yet. Someone is here for me." "Who is there?" "I don't know. Someone very important. He has something to tell me." "What does he tell you?" "That I have lived a good life, until the end. I should not have ended my life. Yet he seems to know I would do what I did." "Is there more?" I asked, pushing this paradox aside. The answer came directly at me now, in a more powerful voice. Was this Thomas, or Pedro, or someone else? I flashed back momentarily to the masters who spoke through Catherine. Except this was years later, and Catherine was not here. "It is the reaching out with love to help another that is important, not the results. Reach out with love. That is all you need to do. Love one another. The results of reaching out with love are not the results you look for. Results to the physical body. You must heal the hearts of men." Both physicians, Thomas and I, were being addressed, and we both listened raptly as the message continued. The voice was more powerful, more sure, more didactic than Pedro's. "I will teach you how to heal the hearts of men. You will understand. Love one another." We could both feel the force of these words as they were impressed into our being. The words were alive. We could never forget them. Later, Pedro told me that he vividly saw and heard everything that this luminous visitor communicated, words that danced with light as they bridged the space between them. I had heard the same words. I was sure they were also meant for me. Important lessons leapt at me. Reach out with love and compassion, and do not worry so much about outcomes. Do not attempt to end your life before its natural time. A higher wisdom deals with outcomes and knows the time for all things. Free will and destiny coexist. Do not measure healing by physical results. Healing occurs at many levels, not just the physical, and real healing must occur at the heart level. Somehow I would learn about healing the hearts of men. Most of all, love one another. Timeless wisdom, easily grasped but practiced by only a few. My mind drifted back to Pedro. Themes of separation and loss plagued his lifetimes. This time they had led him to suicide. He had been warned about not ending a life prematurely. But losses were occurring anew, and grief had returned. Would he remember, or would hopeless despair overtake him once again? How devastating it is to be a healer who cannot heal his patient. Elizabeth's failure in ancient Egypt. Pedro's despair as Thomas, the Ohio physician. My own painful experiences as a healer. My first frustration as a healer who could not stop the onslaught of rampaging illness occurred more than 25 years ago during my very first clinical rotation as a third-year student at Yale Medical School. I began with pediatrics, and I was assigned to Danny, a 7-year-old boy with a large Wilms tumor. This is a malignant tumor of the kidney that occurs almost exclusively in childhood. The younger the child, the better the prognosis. 7 was not considered young for this cancer. Danny was the first real patient in my medical career. Prior to him, all of my experience had been in classrooms, lecture halls, laboratories, and sitting for endless hours in front of my textbooks. The third year began our clinical experience. We were assigned to hospital wards with real patients. Enough facts and theory. The time for practical application had arrived. I had to draw Danny's blood for the laboratory tests, and I took care of all the minor procedures, called scut work by more advanced practitioners but very meaningful to third-year medical students. Danny was a wonderful child, but our bond was even stronger and the more special because he was my first patient. Danny fought heroically. He had lost his hair from the powerful but toxic chemotherapy treatments. His belly was severely bloated. Yet he was rallying, and his parents and I took hope. A good percentage of children were able to recover from this type of malignancy at that time. I was the youngest member of the treatment team. The medical student usually knew less clinical medicine than the intern, resident, or attending physician, all of whom were incredibly busy with their work. On the other hand, the medical student had more time to spend with the patient and family. In general, the medical student also placed a higher priority on getting to know the patient and his family. We would customarily be assigned to talk to the family or to convey messages to the patient. Danny was my main patient, and I liked him a lot. I spent many hours sitting on the side of his bed, playing games, reading stories, or just talking. I admired his courage. I also spent time with his parents, frequently in Danny's dark and drab hospital room. We even ate together in the cafeteria. They were frightened but also encouraged by his rally. Suddenly, Danny took a drastic turn for the worse. A dangerous respiratory infection overwhelmed his weakened immune system. He had difficulty breathing, and his usually bright eyes turned dull and glazed. I was shunted aside by the more senior members of the medical team. Antibiotics were started and stopped and changed, to no avail. Danny slid downhill. I stayed with his mother and father, feeling helpless and horrified. The illness won. Danny died. I was too upset to spend more time with his parents, beyond a brief word and a hug. I identified with their pain as much as I could at that time. 3 years later, when my own son died in a hospital, I understood even more. But at the time, I felt some vague responsibility for his death, as if I should have done something, anything, to avert it. The failure to heal strikes at the very soul of every healer. I understood Thomas's despair. Far fewer psychiatric patients die of their illnesses. Yet the inability to help a severely disturbed patient evokes chords of the same frustration and sense of helplessness. When I was chairman of the psychiatry department at Mount Sinai, I treated a beautiful and talented woman in her 30s. A successful career woman, she had recently entered into a happy marriage. Gradually she became paranoid, and the paranoia was worsening despite medicines, despite therapy, despite every intervention. Neither I nor any consultant I called in could determine why, because her course and symptoms and tests were very atypical for schizophrenia, mania, or any other of the usual psychoses. She had begun to deteriorate soon after a trip to the Far East, and one test showed extremely high antibodies to a parasite. Still, no medical or psychiatric treatment helped, and she gradually worsened. Again, I had felt the pangs of helplessness, the frustration of the healer who could not heal. To reach out with love, to do your best and not be so concerned with results or outcomes, that is the answer. This simple concept, ringing so true to me, is the balm of understanding that healers need. In a sense, I had reached out with love to Danny, and he had reached back to me. Chapter 19, or ever the knightly years were gone with the old world to the grave, I was a king in Babylon and you were a Christian slave. I saw, I took, I cast you by, I bent and broke your pride. And a myriad suns have set and shone since then upon the grave decreed by the king in Babylon to her that had been his slave. The pride I trampled is now my scathe, for it tramples me again. The old resentment lasts like death, for you love, yet you refrain. I break my heart on your hard unfaith, and I break my heart in vain. William Ernest Henley. Elizabeth was frustrated and despondent. Her new relationship had lasted for only 2 dates. Bob was avoiding her. She had known him casually for more than a year, through work. He was successful and handsome and shared many of her interests. He told her that his long-term affair with a married woman had just ended. Bob had had several short-term relationships with other women, but there always seemed to be something lacking in these women. According to him, they would turn out to be superficial or unintelligent or not share his values, and he would end the relationships. His married lover would always accept him back. Her husband was rich, but their relationship lacked passion. She would not leave her husband and their affluent life. "You're different from the others," Bob swore to Elizabeth. We have so much more in common. He told Elizabeth that she was more intelligent than any of the others, more beautiful, that he knew their relationship could last. Elizabeth convinced herself that Bob was right. He was there all the time, and I never really noticed, she thought. Sometimes the answer is right in front of your eyes and you never see it. She forgot that the reason she never really noticed Bob and his blonde good looks was that she never felt a chemistry with him. She was lonely and desperate for a man's arms. She listened to her head and ignored her heart's warning. Their first date was very promising. They went out for a casual dinner, a good movie, and intimate conversation while watching the wind-whipped waves on the beach under the cool light of a nearly full moon. I could fall in love with you, he told her, teasing her with a promise that would never be fulfilled. Her head carefully heard every word, ignoring the lack of response from her heart. The second date seemed fine. She had a good time, and she sensed that he did, too. His affection seemed genuine, and he hinted at sex in the future. But he never called back. Finally, she called him. He said that he wanted to see her again but that he was very busy, and it was difficult to pick an exact time. He assured her he had not had a change of heart, he did want to see her. He just couldn't tell her when. Why do I always pick losers? She asked me. What's wrong with me? You don't pick losers, I told her. Here's a handsome and successful man who told you he was interested and available. Don't blame yourself. I didn't say so, but inwardly I knew she was right. She was picking losers, in this case an emotional loser. It turned out he could not leave the safety of his married lover. He chose to remain dependent and safe. Elizabeth became the victim of his fear and his lack of courage. Better now than later, I thought. Elizabeth was strong, she would recover. Elizabeth asked if we still had time to attempt a regression. She could sense something important was near the surface, and she was anxious to find it, so we proceeded. After she emerged in an ancient past life, I was not sure we had made the right decision. She saw a land of broad, rolling plains and flat-topped hills. A land of like animals and small agile horses, of large rounded tents and nomadic wanderers. It was a land of passion, and it was a land of violence. Her husband was away with most of the other men, hunting or raiding. The enemy struck, flying in on waves of horses against the depleted defenders. Her husband's parents were killed first, hacked down by broad, razor-sharp swords. Her baby was killed next, gutted by a spear. A shudder convulsed her spirit. She wanted to die, too, but such was not her destiny. Captured by the young warriors because of her beauty, she became the property of the strongest of the invading horde. A few other young women were also spared. Let me die. She pleaded to her captor, but he would not allow it. You are mine now, he said simply. You will live in my tent, and you will be my wife. Except for her husband, whom she would never see again. All her loved ones were dead. She had no choice. She attempted to escape several times, only to be quickly caught. Her suicide attempts were similarly thwarted. She hardened herself, and her depression turned into a constant smoldering anger, devouring her capacity to love. Her spirit withered, and she merely existed, a hardened heart trapped in a living body. No jail could be as confining or as cruel. Let's go back in time, I suggested. Let's go back before your village was raided. I counted back from 3 to 1. What do you see? I asked. Her face was now serene and peaceful as she remembered the early years, growing up, laughing and playing with the man she would eventually marry. She loved this childhood friend dearly, and he returned this love to her. She was at peace. Do you recognize this man you married? Look into his eyes. No, I don't, she finally answered. Look at the others in your village. Do you recognize anyone? She looked carefully at her relatives and friends in that lifetime. Yes. Yes, my mother is there. Elizabeth gasped happily. She is the mother of my husband. We are very close. When my own mother died, she took me in as a daughter. I recognize her. Do you recognize anyone else? I inquired. She lives in the largest tent, with the flags and white feathers, she answered, ignoring my question. Her face darkened. They killed her, too. she lamented, jumping back to the massacre. Who killed her? Where did they come from? From the east, from beyond the wall. This is where they have taken me. Do you know the name of their land? She pondered this question. No. It seems to be somewhere in Asia, in the northern part. Maybe the west of China. We have oriental features. It's okay, I responded. Let's move ahead in time within that lifetime. What happens to you? I was finally allowed to kill myself, after I had grown older and was not so attractive anymore, she answered, without much emotion. I think they grow tired of me, she added. She was floating now, having left her body. I asked her to review her life. What do you see? What were the lessons? What did you learn? Elizabeth was silent for a few moments. And then she answered, I learned many things. I learned of anger and the foolishness of holding on to anger. I could have worked with the younger children, with the old ones, with the sick ones, in the enemy's town. I could have taught them. I could have loved them. But I never allowed myself to love. I never allowed myself to let my anger dissipate. I never allowed myself to open my heart once again. And these children, at least, were innocent. They were souls entering into this world. They had nothing to do with the raid, with the deaths of my loved ones. And yet I blamed them, too. I carried the anger even to the new generations, and this is foolish. It could hurt them, but most of all it harmed me. I never permitted myself to love again. She paused. And I had much love to give. She paused again and then seemed to speak from an even higher source. Love is like a fluid, she began. It fills up crevices. It fills empty spaces of its own accord. It is people who stop it by erect and false barriers. And when love cannot fill our hearts and our minds, when we are disconnected from our souls, which consist of love, then we all go crazy. I considered her words. I knew that love was important, perhaps even the most important thing in the world. But it had never dawned on me that the absence of love could cause us to lose our minds. I remembered the famous monkey experiments of the psychologist, Dr. Harry Harlow, in which young monkeys deprived of touching, of nurturing, of love became completely asocial, physically ill, or even died. They could not survive intact without it. Loving is not an option. It is a necessity. I turned back to Elizabeth. Look ahead in time. How does what you learned then affect you now? And how can this learning, how can this remembering, help you in your current life to feel happier, more peaceful, more loving? I must learn to let go of anger, to not hold it in, to recognize its roots and let it go. I must feel free to love, to not hold back, and yet I still search. I haven't found someone to love completely, unconditionally. There always seems to be a problem. She fell silent for half a minute. Suddenly she was speaking with a voice much deeper and slower than usual. The room felt very cold. God is one, she began. She struggled for words. It is all one vibration, one energy. The only difference is the rate of vibration. So God and people and rocks have the same relationship as steam and water and ice. Everything, all that is made up of the one. Love breaks down the barriers and creates unity. That which creates barriers and creates separateness and differences is ignorance. You must teach them these things. That was the end of the message. Elizabeth was resting. I thought of Catherine's messages, which seemed so similar to Elizabeth's. Even the room felt cold when Catherine would relay these messages, much as the room felt cold with Elizabeth. I pondered her words. Healing is the act of bringing together, removing the barriers. Separation is what causes harm. Why is it so difficult for people to grasp this concept? Although I have conducted more than 1,000 individual past life regressions with my patients and many more in groups, I have had only a half dozen of these experiences myself. I have had some remembrances in vivid dreams and during a shiatsu, or acupressure, treatment. Some of these are described in my earlier books. When my wife, Carol, finished a course in hypnotherapy to add to her skills as a social worker, she conducted a few past life regression sessions with me as the patient. I wanted to experience this with someone whom I trusted and who was well trained. I had been practicing meditation for years, and I went under deeply and quickly. When the memories started to flood into my mind, they were primarily visual and quite vivid, like my dream images. I could see myself as a young man from a wealthy Jewish family in Alexandria, around the time of Christ. Our community, I somehow knew, helped to finance the huge golden doors of the Great Temple in Jerusalem. My studies included Greek and the philosophy of the ancient Greeks, especially the followers of Plato and Aristotle. I remembered one fragment of my life as that young man, when I attempted to augment my classical education by traveling among the clandestine desert communities in the southern deserts and caves of Palestine and the north of Egypt. Each community was a type of learning center, usually of mystical and esoteric knowledge. Some of these probably were Essene villages. I traveled very simply, carrying only a little food and some clothes. Just about everything I needed was provided for me along the way. My family had money, and we were known to these peoples. The spiritual knowledge I was acquiring was exciting and accelerated, and I enjoyed the journey. For several weeks along the way from community to community, I was joined by a man about my age. He was taller than I and had intense brown eyes. We both wore robes and had cloths on our heads. He emanated peace, and as we studied together with the wise men of the villages, he soaked up the teachings much more quickly than I. Afterward, he would teach me as we camped together by desert fires. After a few weeks, we separated. I went to study at a small synagogue near the Great Pyramid, and he went to the West. Many of my patients, including Elizabeth and Pedro, have remembered lives in the area of ancient Palestine. Many have remembered Egypt. For me, as for them, the images seemed extremely vivid and quite real. Chapter 20, O youth or young man, who fancy that you are neglected by the gods, know that if you become worse you shall go to the worse souls, or if better to the better, and in every succession of life and death you will do and suffer what like may fitly suffer at the hands of like. This is the justice of heaven, Plato. Sometimes life's most significant events are upon you before you are aware of them, like the silent approach of a jungle cat. How could you not have noticed something of such magnitude? The camouflage is psychological. Denial, the act of not seeing what is right before your eyes, because you really don't want to see, is the greatest disguise. Add in fatigue, distractions, rationalizations, mental escape, and all the other businesses of the mind that get in the way. Fortunately, destiny's persistence can pierce the disguises and distinguish that which you need to see, the foreground emerging from the background, like mastering one of those magic eye pictures. Over the past 15 years, I have often treated couples or families who have discovered each other together in past lives. Sometimes I have regressed couples who simultaneously and for the first time have found themselves interacting in the same prior lifetime. These revelations are often shocking to the couple. They have not experienced anything like this before. They are silent while the scenes are unfolding in my psychiatric office. It is only afterward, after emerging from the relaxed, hypnotic state, that they first discover they have been watching the same scenes, feeling the same emotions. It is only then that I also become aware of their past connections. But with Elizabeth and Pedro, everything was backward. Their lives, and their lifetimes, were unfolding independently and quite separately, in my office. They did not know each other. They had never met. They were from different countries and cultures. They came to the office on different days. Seeing them both separately and never even suspecting a link between them, I did not make the connection. They had loved each other and lost each other across lifetimes. Why didn't I see it before? Was it even my destiny? Am I supposed to be some cosmic matchmaker? Was I distracted, fatigued, in denial? Was I rationalizing away coincidences? Or was I right on schedule? The idea dawning at its sunrise, the way it was planned all along. It came to me one evening. Eli? I had heard it from Elizabeth, weeks before, in my office. Earlier that day, Pedro could not remember his name. In a hypnotic trance, he had emerged in an ancient lifetime, one he had previously remembered in the office. In that lifetime, He had died after being dragged by leather-clad soldiers. His life ebbed away as his head rested in his beloved daughter's lap, and she rocked rhythmically with despair. Perhaps there was more to learn from that time. Once again, he remembered dying in her arms, his life fading away.